Hey guys, it's Rohan here. This is a previously unreleased episode with Stevon Voice, a friend of the podcast, firm aerospace medic, and an emergency medicine resident. It was recorded back in 2020, so we've all moved on in our careers since then. But we felt that this great episode is just too good not to release. So we hope you enjoy it.
3, 2, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0.
Hi everyone, my name is Rohan Sant.
And my name is Daniel Olaya, and we'd like to thank you for joining us on the latest episode of the Aerospace Medicine Podcast.
So our guest today is Stevon Voice, a medical student based out of San Antonio, Texas, who is an up-and-coming star in the field of aerospace medicine.
Now this is a funny one because I actually met Stevon at the Aerospace Medicine Association conference in Las Vegas in 2019. And since I met him, I knew he was someone we had to have on the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Daniel was very, very excited when we met Stevon for the first time. And he's amazing since he balances his medical studies with learning to be a private pilot. He's a mentorship coordinator at the Aerospace Medical Association and also volunteers on a yearly basis over at the University of Texas Medical Branch over in Galveston in Texas.
With that, I have the absolute pleasure of introducing Mr. Stevon Voice.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. Hey.
Hi, people. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, really, really good. Stevon, I'd just like to say thank you once again for joining us and how amazing it is to think back at how we met each other. I remember we were doing the interviewer-mentee-mentor session at the asthma conference, and I saw you and I thought, who's this young guy looking all cool with an asthma badge on? You know, he's too young to be here. You know, what is he doing? And I just had to say hello.
Oh man, yeah, that's funny. It was the speed mentoring event at the asthma event that we hold every year. And at that particular one, I believe it was the last day, I was coordinating with a few other of our AMDRO members. That's the aerospace medicine students and residents organization. And after I got done, I was cleaning up and I saw you and you were sticking around. You were vlogging. I was like, who's this guy vlogging everything? I was like, I've seen him throughout the days at this conference with this camera on this stick. And he was talking. I was like, who's he talking to? And so, I introduced myself naturally because I don't mind coming up to people or strangers. And, you know, you were such a nice, welcoming young guy. And, you know, I just had to know where you came from. And, you know, I heard your accent and I was like, he's not from here. I was like, I got to know where he's from. And so it was such a pleasure to meet you. We linked up. We even met another mentor-ish gentleman out there. And I think he was with the U.S. Army and he gave information. And so it was really nice, and we stayed in contact, added each other on social media, and have been supporting each other ever since.
That's it. No, it really is magical. And I think that's true for this whole environment and this industry. Everyone's linked in their own special way, and it's just about making that connection. But without further ado, we've got some really interesting things that we want to talk about when it comes to your career and how far you've come and where you're going. So, Rohan, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So, first question we want to kind of ask our guests is that obviously, Stevon, you are a medical student, but what was the story? What got you into medicine in the first place?
Okay. Well, after I got out of undergrad in Corpus Christi, I was looking for a job, and I had a great forensics professor that told me he had found me an internship, and he didn't tell me where it was at. Mm-hmm. He just said, I need you to buy some scrubs and at 7 a.m. get a box of donuts and show up at this address. true story.
That sounds so dodgy.
His name is Mr. Graham, John. Oh, okay. Graham. He was my forensics professor. I did a biomed and concentration in forensics. And at the time, I didn't have a job. And so I was doing music entertainment. That was my passion at the time. And mm-hmm. I showed up to this address, and it happened to be at the medical examiner's office in Corpus Christi. And I was very surprised, because the only part of forensics I was interested in at the time and knew about was crime scene investigation. Mm-hmm. So
lots of CSI.
Right, right. But it wasn't as exciting as I thought it was. You know, it's definitely not like it is on TV. And the medical examiner's office took to my heart very fast. So I interned for 6 months, no pay. And after my 6 months, the medical examiner told me he talked to another medical examiner in Dallas. And that medical examiner was looking for an autopsy technician who had some experience. So he asked me if I wanted to go back home, because I'm from the Dallas area, Terrell, Texas, to be exact. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah. So I got my first job at Dallas County Medical Examiner's Office and started working as an autopsy tech. And while my time at there, I had a couple cases that were plane accidents, mm-hmm. civilian plane crashes that we did cases on. And it wasn't like any other accident, motor vehicle crash or accident, autopsy procedure. This one, we not only had to do our job as the county medical examiner's office, but the FAA had their own box of talk and tissue collection as well. Mm. And I had no clue who the FAA was. I had no clue what accident investigation was. I had no clue of anything. I just knew that somebody made me work for 3 more hours on a case.
Who are these guys?
Right. And so I was like, hey, who are you? Who, what do you want that I already have here? And so I looked into the FAA and accident investigation, and I fell in love, because I already liked aviation, but I never saw myself doing a career in it. I never had a mentor or anybody come into my life that looked like me or was from where I was from that made me see myself in that position. So I never imagined myself going towards piloting or being an astronaut at that time.
Sure.
Wow. That's really interesting, because you actually saw it from the other side. Most people see flying, see pilots, but you came from the air crash investigation side. You see dead bodies in front of you, essentially. You were seeing a disaster in front of you, and then you came through it to it from that angle. That's interesting.
Yes, I saw what I didn't want to happen ever again, and I said, how can I prevent? That was my question. I was like, how can I prevent things from happening? And so I was like, maybe I should go to med school. I was like, who would be better than the person on the front line that sees them before they get to this table? And I said, I wanted to intervene in the drift. So I started studying for my MCAT, and I wanted to get my GPA up. So I applied for a master's degree. That's whenever I found the University of the Incarnate Word, School of Osteopathic Medicine. They had a master's, an MBS program, Master's of Biomedical Science. I applied to that, and that's what took me to San Antonio and got me into my master's, which is where I found out about aerospace medicine at a bigger scale. The School of Aerospace Medicine through the Air Force was actually the campus of my medical school now. And it almost felt like divine intervention.
All the stars were aligning. Everything was making sense. All you had to do was step forward.
Right. So I went around this campus because a lot of it's barren. It's a historical landmark. So a lot of the buildings aren't changed. It doesn't look as glammy as people would expect. So I had a textbook called The Fundamentals of Aerospace Medicine, but I bought it from Half Price Books. So it was from 1984. And in the beginning of it, it showed my school and said the Aerospace Medical School is located in Brook City, San Antonio. And I was like, can't be. I'm on Brook City. I live here, and I don't see anything about aerospace medicine anywhere around here. So from that, I go searching around the campus, and I'm looking for artifacts. I'm just looking for historical things. And finally, I'm Googling, and then I find this hangar that's about a couple miles away from the campus. It was the Edward White Jr. Museum at the time.
Ed White, the astronaut.
Yes, he was the first San Antonian astronaut.
Wow.
They made a museum after him, and it was a hangar. And they moved all of his stuff to Wright-Patterson, I believe. And this hangar was vacant and they were refurbishing it. And so they had it under construction. The doors were closed and I would just go visit this place all the time until I finally found the aerospace high altitude centrifuge lab, which was hidden behind my school. And I had no clue what the name was at the time, but I had passed it many times. At the time, it was called Wiley Lab. And I was looking for a different name that the textbook said. But granted, it was from 1984, so I should have known better. I found Wiley Labs and I knocked on the door and they were like, can I help you? And I was like, I'm interested in aerospace medicine and I'm doing a master's thesis / capstone on decompression sickness. And I know a little bit about it, but I would like to know more. And they were like, well, we're busy right now, but if you want to come by for a tour later, you know, you can talk to us later. And I was like, all right. And the way I saw it was I saw a win. I was like, okay, they didn't say no. I didn't get in right now, but they didn't say no. Eventually, what happened is the Air Force, they would come to our medical campus to get lunch at the food trucks. So I ended up talking to one of the airmen and he said, I can get you a tour. So I walked in with him the next following week. And the guy that was at the door the first time was like, hey, you're in here. And I was like, yeah.
What are you going to do about it?
Yeah, I'm in here now. And so, you know, I start talking to people and getting to know people and just being a people person. And I asked if they had any internship positions and they were like, no, we've never had an intern. And I was just like, well, I could really help y'all out, give you another hand. I don't know too much, but, you know, I'm willing to do as much as I can. I'm really trying to go far in this field. And so they were like, if we talk to HR, maybe we can create an internship position. So by the end of my first year of medical school, they created an internship position at this lab. And it's called KBR Company. And they made an internship position and they actually paid me. And it became a now something that wasn't there now became something into reality for even future people that might want to come through and do this.
That is something else.
Right. Wow. And so since then, I started researching with them as a physiology research assistant. Since I was new behind everything, I started off just following all the physiologists and PhD scientists that in their particular fields and watching them do all of their works as far as data collection, operating the machines, the centrifuge, the altitude chambers. I was taught how to be an inside observer where I wear a high pressure oxygen mask and helmet and I sit inside the chamber and watch the subjects go through hypoxia symptoms. And if they need me to administer oxygen, I would do so. And I would also just record what I saw because different experiments that we would look at in the altitude chamber would be things such as rapid decompression, useful time of consciousness. So we would put somebody through rapid decompression and we would count and try to see their vitals. We would see how much time they could still do normal tasks until it got to the point where their oxygen was too low or they started showing signs of hypoxia in a sense where it could become detrimental that we needed to pull them down. And we would just do that on different personnels that volunteered or signed up. So we can gather this information and see what would be useful to add to different emergency protocols, safety protocols, and
okay. Did you get to try a time in the hyperbaric?
The hyperbaric chamber? No, we have some at that facility, but they were all not being used at the time. The only machines that were being used was just the high altitude chamber and the centrifuge. And I did get to go in the high altitude chamber and I got to go up to 25,000. And when I went up to 25,000 for that profile, we went up that high and then we did rapid decompression. And we had a piece of paper and we were doing different tasks such as math, writing our names, drawing shapes, and we would start checking off symptoms we were having as we were having them. And then once we've come down, if you made it through and you didn't need oxygen administration or for us to descend, then you made it through and you became half that.
What was it like? Was it scary?
It was interesting. To me, I felt like it wasn't scary because the scariest moment to me, I think, is taking the step. And that's of everything. I mean, it's just like if someone was skydiving. The scariest part, I believe, is either going up to the highest point where you're getting ready or getting ready to jump off. Because once you actually do the deed, you've already committed. So me being scared at that time, to me, I can't operate like that because I'm going into survival mode. And so I'm thinking about what do I need to do to make sure I get back or to make this the best experience of my life. And so as I'm up there, I'm feeling the gas expand. I'm feeling every gas expand. I'm feeling my sinuses starting feeling like they're clogging up and I'm praying that I didn't have a stuffy nose because that would hurt. My sinuses were open up. I'm feeling my ears popping. Your stomach is rumbling because gas in there is moving.
You mentioned a lot of stuff that's really interesting in terms of rapid decompression and stuff. And I just want to make sure that we're not losing anybody at this particular point. Can you just very briefly just talk about what you mean by rapid decompression? And also like what you mentioned a few of the things that it can have an effect on your cognition or your ability to do things. But what other effects does it have?
Yes. Decompression is basically when you're going from a high to low pressure. And so we have, I believe it's Henry's law in physics. So when Henry's law, it states that gas expands as it goes from high to low pressure. So if you think of something like a bottle of soda that's carbonated and you shake up that bottle of soda, because it's in this bottle, all that gas and these bubbles are trapped and they're pulled in because they're under such a high pressure. You open up that cap and release it into the atmosphere. Now it is exposed to this lighter, more open pressure. And all that gas wants to just get out of there as fast as it can, which is what you see by your fizz and flushing of soda coming out and spilling on the floor and upset. So that's Henry's law, and that is basically what's happening to us as we're going from an atmosphere that's under a pressure here on Earth to a lighter pressure out in space.
Got it.
Or higher up in altitude. And so what that is explaining is that just like that bottle of soda is your body, and you have many gases inside of you that are contained. And as we go up higher and higher and higher, they want to get free. They want to release. And so they're going to find the easiest route to go. And that can be through your ears, your eyes, your nose, mouth, your bottom.
A lot of way of putting it.
Yes, that's precisely what's happening as you're going up in these altitude chambers to higher and higher altitudes when it comes to gas.
Hey guys, it's Rohan here again. I'm just popping up to say that in the previous section we talk about gas laws, but we do get a little bit muddled about which law is being applied, so don't worry if it's slightly different from what you think. I'm going to briefly explain now. So gases expanding when they go from an area of high pressure to low pressure is kind of the same as saying that when the volume of a gas is increasing, that the pressure must decrease. Another way of explaining that is the opposite. So when the pressure increases, the volume decreases. And this is inversely proportional, and that is described by Boyle's law. When you think about it, gases moving from a high pressure to a low pressure does make sense because, really simply, if you've got a high pressure, that's pushing that gas into the area of low pressure. And this is another interpretation, actually, of Boyle's law, P1 V1. Equals P2 V2, which you can look into later if you so wish. Now, Henry's law is talking about dissolved gas in a solution and how much of that dissolved gas in a solution will then go into the atmosphere above. If the above atmosphere contains a lot of that gas or a high partial pressure of that gas, then more of that gas can then be dissolved into the solution. Whereas if there's a low partial pressure of that gas above the solution, and there's a lot dissolved in, then that dissolved gas will then enter the atmosphere above it or bubble into it. And this is Henry's law. So I hope that all makes sense, and let's get back to the pod.
So as a medical student, you were taking a deep dive into aerospace medicine. It normally takes quite advanced doctors or scientists who've been in the field for a while, for a number of years, before they get exposed to those sort of experiments and those that sort of environment. You must have felt great. You must have felt very privileged to be doing that.
I really did. I felt like it was an honor, not only because I was learning things in the field that I've been wanting to, but it was who I was learning it from. It was where I was learning it. I think that a lot of these advancements that I've been able to make have been on behalf of great individuals that have taken a shot and a chance on me. It's an historical ground. So I'm not only elated, to be where I'm at for my medical school, but this is a primary site of where our field was established. So I have nothing but respect for this ground I'm stepping on, these buildings I'm walking through, these books I'm seeing, these individuals that I'm growing to learn and know as I'm passing their office that have been working in the field for 30 plus years. These men and women that have made contributions to the field that some of them I can't even name. I just got to meet them once and they left, but I got to shake their hands or lay eyes on them. And I was told, like, this person helped create this and they created that. And I'm like, you basically created my textbook that I'm learning this about. And these men and women are walking textbooks. So I looked at it as this is something so invaluable. Even if I didn't get paid, this is something that as a new generation going into the field of aerospace medicine, you want to be able to know about the past. You want to know about the people that contributed. You want to know about everything that someone did wrong and right. So we don't repeat things. We don't waste time on things that we know that work. We don't continue to make mistakes that we know haven't worked. And, and we don't get full of ourselves to understand that sometimes, things are going to be a bump in the road and it might be later when we see things we've put in now coming to fruition.
Precisely. So how important is that research that you're doing? Because a lot of the stuff that you're researching, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of it we already know. Right. We already know those laws. We already know Boyle's, Henry's, Charles' law. But tell us, what's the importance of you doing that research? What is it doing?
So I felt that the importance of doing that research and covering things that have already been covered, so to speak, is important because we need to overstand this environment.
I like that, overstand. I've not heard that one before.
We do. We need to overstand it because not everybody is going to have the same reactions to this environment that we found out to be somewhat of a normalcy.
Yeah,
gotcha. Not everybody has the same useful time of consciousness. There's individuals that I've seen in research with altitude chambers or even in the centrifuge withstanding high Gs that can tolerate being in a hypoxic state for minutes that you wouldn't believe versus someone else could not have time to operate in less than a minute, maybe 1 minute or 2 minutes.
And that's actually, we just want to highlight, that's actually really important, right? Because especially how, obviously now with the COVID situation, we're not flying as much, but prior to this, more people were flying than ever before. We've got the advent of reusable rockets, which was not ever thought of before. There's multiple industries in the idea of space tourism, which previously was the preserve of essentially, unless you're an astronaut and have done months, if not years of training, almost your entire life for this particular post, you can't get up into space. But then now people are able to actually go there as a space tourist. It has to be, what you're saying is really important because you need to make sure that you understand and why different people react in different ways so that you can safely ensure the future of this industry and make sure it's going to progress, because it's budding right now, but it's going to sprout. And as me and Daniel have discussed, it's going to grow exponentially. I think we're going to see a new dawn of a new era when it comes to really when space tourism and space in general becomes a much more accessible field than what it is currently, I think, anyway.
You know what they're calling it? I watched a TED Talk the other day. They're calling it, or some people are calling it, the Mars generation.
Oh, really? That's so cool.
Yeah. Mm. The Mars generation. Well, we'll see. We'll see if that becomes a thing.
You're not wrong, man. That's going to happen soon. Like, it's going to, you know, there's a lot of there's a lot of progress being made in that sort of field as well. And it's really cool that, Stevon, you're at almost the epicenter of all of that stuff, where all of that is happening, and where that all that happened, that's where you are.
That's almost like studying the Renaissance in Florence. You're there. Where it happened.
That is exactly the way it feels, because at the front of our medical school, we have a plaque where John F. Kennedy did his speech, where he said to throw the cap over the walls of space and we'll go after it the day before his assassination in Dallas.
Wow.
He did that speech to declarate the School of Aerospace Medicine at that campus. And we kept a plaque with part of that speech at the front of our medical school. And every day I would walk by and read it and go about my way and go back to my car, go back to the school, wherever I would go to. And I remember so many people would be wondering, why am I just standing in front of it? And I'm like, I don't know where we're at.
Yeah.
And so it was such a beautiful thing, because I was able to even help with my school, just expanding the knowledge of where we are. When people wanted to know, like, what's so important about Brooks? And so I was able to host what we call the Brooks Heritage event. And we invited all the airmen and that were before, that came and graduated from the school back when, and the people that were involved with it now. And we basically had like a reunion. So all these men and women that went to school there for aerospace medicine, nurses, doctors, scientists, were able to all gather and tour the campus again, now that it's 2016, 17, 18, 19, you know, they're able to see these new times of like, wow, this room, this building that used to be that, y'all are using it for this now.
Yeah.
And et cetera. And so that was able to take them through memory lane, but also teach us something, because what was, we don't know. So they were able to tell us what was going on in that room that I have lecture in. And they were like, well, that room was actually for this instead of that. And I also got to take them on the tour to KBR and the centrifuge and altitude chamber, because I worked there. And so I did a tour with them at the medical campus, and I got to help tour them at the facility. And that felt like such a blessing, because it felt like I had this weird connection in time and space, where I was holding on to 1963, and my other hand I was holding on to 2019, and I was just like, you know, we're still pushing, and not too much is different in our field besides, you know, the most recent advancements. But like you said, the importance of re-studying the same thing is because each of us need to know those principles down packed. You can't just know that just so you can have it in a dinner conversation. You need to know this because at any point in time, there's somebody's life that's going to be at stake. Like Rohan mentioned, like, we're about to go to a generation where this is about to become normal for people to take themselves to a physiologic challenge that they might not be ready for. And if you don't know these principles, you know, I'm not the one to say that I want to say it. Mm. But when I first started this field, I started off by seeing accidents.
Mm. Yeah. Wow.
And so if I brought myself forward, all I can think about is, this is a field that has a high accident rate. And if you don't pay attention to the small details that you think you know already, those can always and most commonly be the things that cause us to backtrack or set us back. And all we need in this generation is for one accident to set aerospace medicine and space medicine back decades.
Yeah.
So you're looking at it almost like reverse engineering a career or an adventure, a occurrence in aerospace medicine. You're looking at it from the rewind. You're looking at it from the accident. That's just so incredible to think about. You're literally reverse engineering aerospace medicine.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I thought it was really cool as well. I wanted to just, Would it be all right if I just asked you a little bit more about what you said about, you know, this is a field with a lot of accidents in it. And obviously you were coming from a place which was civilian, I assume, right? When you were working in the place in Dallas as the autopsy technician. Was there anything in particular in terms of was there any common causes of crashes which were just repeated things that, you know, you then talk about emergency procedures later on that you were working on in terms of your research. Was there any way that you could be able to fix some of the problems through your research that you ended up, you know, seeing?
I would say when I was doing autopsies, what I saw was either medical problems that weren't addressed. So it was a human factor. And the human factor seems to be more common than the mechanical one.
Mm.
And so with human factor, it was either an individual was on a medication that they weren't taking, or, and let's say, for instance, someone was on hypertensives, and they basically had medical conditions, and or when the accident was investigated and I got to see what the report was, it was more so about someone that was very skilled, highly trained, had been doing it for years, and they made a dumb mistake because they were either A, trying to show off for their friends, and, you know, this caused them to lose concentration. They didn't pay attention to how low they were in altitude, and they made maneuvers that cost them their life. And so when you fast forward it, and I'm in the research realm, and we're looking at pilots. This is not civilian pilots. And so this research, a lot of it, I couldn't publish or anything because it was all orders either through military or special contracting that you wanted to use our labs specifically. So I got to work on it, and I have people that can vouch for me that I was in there. But as far as publications and the details, I could never say, because it was for particular missions.
Of course.
Sure, of course.
But the things that can be said were that same thing, question between human error and mechanical error. Are we dealing with a problem with our jets that are mechanical? Is it our O2 problem? Is it O2 sensors? Is it delivery? Or is it a user problem? Are pilots properly breathing through pressure mask? Are they using pressure mask? You know, and if you're not in the cockpit, you know, you don't know. And you also have to trust the honesty of your pilot. So integrity comes into a play as well. But what we've seen from a number of things is that the mechanics don't seem to have been changed. And the only thing that I can always say is variable is human reaction.
Yep. Human factors. And that's why this field is growing more and more, and people are understanding the significance of it. Human factors is an amazingly interesting area, and I'm super excited about getting more and more into it. Stevon, I wanted to quickly rewind and have you give us a top line about who you are and where you are. So your actual position right now. So where you're born, where you're from, a little bit about your family, and like the position and the job you do right now. So I don't know if you could just give us a little nicely articulated thing about that.
Yes.
That's okay.
I'm from Terrell, Texas. That's East Texas in relation to Dallas, about 30 minutes out. And I'm currently living in San Antonio, Texas. I go to the University of the Incarnate Word School of Osteopathic Medicine. It's a mouthful, but it's also said as UIWSOM, so UIWSOM. And I'm currently a OMS3, osteopathic medical student, third year, finishing that up. I'm on my last rotation, family medicine. And then I'll be entering into fourth year and starting electives and applying for residency.
Amazing. Thank you. Can you tell us the difference between osteopathic medicine and the other type of medicine, or what is the difference? Because us in the UK, in Europe, we don't have that.
So there's two. There's allopathic, which is the MD route, and then there's osteopathic, the DO route. Both are four-year medical schools. Both go to residency, traditional residencies, any specialty, and also any subspecialty. So virtually, they're the same in regards to your time and training and your opportunity for becoming a physician and any type or particular physician, just putting that out there. The difference was that there was a gentleman by the name of A.T. Steele that was an MD and decided to change his philosophy on how he wanted to approach treating patients. Instead of looking at them all in system organ based, as in you come to me with a liver problem, I only look at your liver. He started looking at things at a more holistic approach where he cared about the musculoskeletal, the bone structure. And then he even went as far as thinking about people's habits and their mindsets as far as their spirituality. And he said that everything affects everything. So if I think a certain way, then I might eat a certain way. If I eat a certain way, then my organs might act a certain way. If my organs act a certain way, then my nervous system's going to act a certain way.
So shouldn't we all be like that? Shouldn't we all be holistic doctors, surely?
In mindset, in the grand scheme, yes. You know, and as far as how people want to go in their area of pursuit for letters behind your name, you know, I say my famous saying, do you. But but outside of that, the mindset, yes. You know, if we're going to be healers of man and woman, we need to be thinking about them as a whole, because healing someone is not just using pharmacological intervention or using a scalpel or doing a physical exam. You know, sometimes healing someone is just listening to them. You know, just the way I like to look at it was, instead of the faucets broke or the faucets were running and water's overflowing over a sink, instead of me continually putting towels down on the floor, why don't I just turn the faucet off, you know? And so
it makes sense, right,
you know. Or, you know, someone stepping on a cat's tail and the cat's hollering and scratching them, and they're like, hey, stop this cat from scratching me, well let's get off the tail. You know, like, and then we'll address that. So that was the philosophy behind why the DO route was started.
Understood.
It interested me because whenever I was doing autopsies, I had a DO that was a resident and she was a forensic pathologist. And I would talk about how I felt about some of these cases that I was doing. And she told me, she's like, I think you would make a great DO. And I was like, what's a DO? And so she introduced me to a book called The Difference a DO Makes. And so I read it and I was like, hey, that sounds like me. And then, you know, shortly after, I found UIW Psalm, and, you know, so on and so on.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for that history lesson. I think that was very useful for me personally. And I think a lot of UK European doctors don't actually get that explanation. So thank you. Now, tell us, what is a flight surgeon? There's a lot of different explanations and definitions about what a flight surgeon is. And I actually haven't put my finger on one that's been consistent all the time. So can you tell us, what is your representation or definition of a flight surgeon?
I would say, man, that's a great question. I would say a flight surgeon is a physician that intervenes between man and machine that take flight. So that is like a simply put definition from me. And when I say intervene, that's broad. You know, it's not just you giving them medical care, because as a flight surgeon, you also need to know a little bit about the aircraft. You need to know about the environment that the aircraft flies in, because if you don't know that environment, you don't know the inside of the cockpit's environment. it's hard to really, really give a good standard of care to that particular patient.
So what's the difference between that and, I understand in the United States, there's also the pilot physician program that is a little bit less common. So what would you describe as the difference between a flight surgeon and what a pilot physician does?
The only difference between the two is that the pilot physician will actually be trained to be a full-on pilot. The flight surgeon and the pilot physician program, both are going to be flight surgeons. And if you didn't do the flight, or if you didn't do the pilot physician program and you became a flight surgeon, it's not a guarantee that you're going to get any piloting time solo. You will get some time flying, but you'll more than likely be in the back seat with another pilot and just getting time and monitoring and watching him or her. And or sometimes some people don't even get that.
So you mentioned some pretty important stuff there, actually. Like, the thing that you had said was the issue with the accidents that were happening back when you were, you know, working in that place in Dallas, is the human factors aspect of things. And that can be potentially a little bit complicated for doctors to understand who don't have a proper understanding of what it's like to be up there in the sky. So do you think a pilot physician is necessary? Because I understand that there's not a huge amount of them. Obviously, it's a really cool career path and it's amazing. But how what's your view upon that? If you can make a view on that, would you say? Or do we need the people to try and bridge that gap between pilot and physician that maybe isn't quite maintained by a flight surgeon, do you think?
Yeah, I think if you want my honest opinion, I think if you're going to the career of becoming a flight surgeon and you really want to make a difference for the aerospace community and the space community by serving the men and women that are pilots and astronauts, I think it behooves you to learn how to fly or really learn a lot about it as far as riding an airplane multiple times, studying about it, because the significance of being a pilot physician is that you know the inside of the cockpit, you know how, you know the ergonomics, you know how it feels when something doesn't go right. So whenever your patient says, "Hey, my right hip is just killing me, I just don't get it," and you've sat in that seat, you have experience, you have something to give them that can help see through their words that they might not be able to explain. And you can now isolate the problem and you can go through towards a proper solution. And so to me, if not everybody's going to be cut out for military, not everybody's going to be cut out for maybe even joining that program. But just like we are in a world that exists and everything is everything, you don't have to do everything just like that. I can go towards pilot physician program and say, "Hey, I learned how to fly a T-38 and I'm also a physician." Mm-hmm. But you can say, "Hey, I'm a physician at this local clinic and I also went to go get my private pilots." You know, you can do that. And equivalently, that's still the same principle. We are just flying two different operating systems. It's not going to be hard for you to adjust after a few months of studying. And I just think that taking that route, if you're going to be in this field, being prepared to take that route of getting into aviation. If you can't get your license, try. If you can't, if you're not going to try and that's not what you want, just try, just get out there and put yourself in the plane as many times as you can, just so you can know how to better serve your patients. Because if you're not doing that, I can say that I feel like we're doing our pilots a disservice if we're telling them they can't, if we're telling them that they can and can't fly and you don't know anything about it.
I read The Right Stuff, which was talking about the Gemini program and the Mercury program, etc. So, you know, the early stages of the space race, essentially from the American side. And what I thought was really, really interesting was that at one point, he had talked about the astronauts' opinions of the physicians, which is essentially that, you know, they're just there to take away my right to fly, almost, was kind of the relationship that they had had. And you're so right, like, as in, you need to be able to, I mean, it makes complete sense from what you're saying. You need to be able to properly understand that field, because your role as that doctor is not to prevent that pilot from flying. It's to try and get them in the air despite that particular little ailment that's going along.
Exactly.
And to try and help them rather than hinder them from progressing in their career. I've got two questions, actually. One is that, you know, one is leading on quite nicely about the fact that, you know, you mentioned that you wanted to get a good understanding of what that pilot environment is like. And I understand that you're actually studying for, have completed your private pilot's license. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm studying and still in the midst of it. I started it at the end of last summer.
Oh, yeah.
And I put a pause on it because I was studying for my board exams.
Sure.
And so since I put a pause on it, I've had it on pause, and I plan on picking it back up in fourth year, because fourth year is a little bit less strenuous, and I've already applied for residency. And so I can kind of relax slightly and use my brain elsewhere.
What's number one on your residency list?
Oh, number one on my residency list is I'm looking for family medicine with a wilderness medicine tract.
Why those? Out of interest.
Well, application. That's why. Family medicine, I feel like, is very diverse. And when I told you about me seeing the things I saw when I was doing autopsies, I told myself I wanted to be in the front line. I wanted to intervene. So I wanted to find issues that don't need to be issues. And I want to stop them. I want to get them nipped in the bud and see if I can direct someone on a new path and help them take control of their own life so they don't have to depend on anybody or anything. You know, turn the water faucet off, as we say.
And where does that put you in the grand scheme of things, doing family medicine with a wilderness medicine, you know, add-on? Like, what does that actually look like practically?
That puts me in a rural environment, more likely an isolated environment. Let's say, for an example, one of the main programs I'm interested in is in Alaska.
Wow. Okay. And, very different from Texas.
Yeah.
All opposites.
And it's an extreme environment. And the people that are the main focus are the bush people. And they're in very remote areas that are sometimes inaccessible only by boat or plane.
Wow.
And they have to have someone that can do multiple things. So the family physicians out there have to not only know how to do general care, but they know a little bit of surgery, and they know a little bit of OB, a little bit of emergency medicine, because you're the only person available. And so if you're the only person available for miles, you kind of have to be a jack of all trades and know how to use limited resources and be useful, and also know how to be very aware of your environment. I think that that's a skill I was grown up on because I was raised in East Texas, and that's a rural area as well.
What do you mean by that, being really aware of your environment? What do you mean by that? How does that influence stuff?
So when I say being aware of your environment, it means you take into consideration all the factors that are uncontrolled.
Okay.
And then when you know everything that you cannot control, then you have identified the things you can control. So for me, when I looked at Alaska, I cannot control the cold. I cannot control the woodlands. I cannot control how isolated these people might be in, or even maybe their resources. But what that means is now that I know all of these factors that are in play, I know how to move correctly. I won't take anything for granted. I will make sure I have the proper PPE, as you would say in the field, in the clinic, but I would have the proper PPE outside as well.
The personal protective equipment. Yeah, absolutely.
Right, right. So I need to make sure I have the right tools. Do I need things to set up a camp? Do I need things to make fire? Do I need things to prevent poison, poisonous contacts? Do I need things to protect myself from wild animals? Do I need things that are going to help someone if they break a bone or I need to stitch? Like, you know, I need to know how to pack up correctly as well as do my job that I'm going to do when I get there. So the same thing. Okay, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you, that makes a lot of sense. But how do you actually go about gaining that level of knowledge? That doesn't sound like something that you can learn from a textbook. Do you know what I mean?
No, it's actually, there are textbooks for it.
Okay.
In the Wilderness Medicine Society.
Sure.
And they're also like regular textbooks that you can get. But when you find programs that have a wilderness medicine tract, they dedicate a year of their program to straight up wilderness medicine activities. So this program in Alaska, during the summer, they do a kayak trip where it's a 3-day kayak and camp. And you learn hands-on how to treat infectious disease. You learn how to do evacuation protocols. And then you also have one in the winter where you do avalanche recovery. You do cave camping, as well as learning how to make fires without any lighters or oil. And the curriculum is actually set out that way. And it's explained. And that's what turned me on to it, because if someone didn't create one, I would try to make one in my own way and put myself through some rigors to feel like I'm getting what I need as far as that experience. But the fact that they had already planned this out gave me a great sense of comfort that I think I would get the right amount of training on top of the miles I would go above and beyond to learn more. And this would train me well for just extreme environments, because in the future, if I want to be a physician astronaut, I would like them to know that I can handle unfavorable conditions with a favorable response.
I like it. Unfavorable conditions with a favorable response. It's good. Now, Stephen, there's a few things that I want to get through. As we draw to a close, I want you to tell us about your experience and your ambition with space medicine and how you feel about everything that's going on. And I want you to tell us about opportunities for students and people, you know, growing in this field and perhaps who aren't even medical students yet. First of all, space medicine. Do you want to be an astronaut?
Yes.
Straight in.
I love it. Yes. Yes.
Quite simply put, it's definitely been an ambition of mine since I've started this journey. But the first question, I know the second one was opportunities, because I have so much for that. But the first question was what now?
You answered. Yes, you do want to be an astronaut. Again, I just want to add on to that. Why?
Okay. So I want to be an astronaut because I want to represent something. I want to represent to people that sometimes think that there are things that aren't for them, that aren't possible, that I can't see myself doing, that you can almost do anything in this world that you set your mind to, if you move correctly and you go about it in the proper way and respect each move properly. I think that representing outreach is what it is for me. I think that as an astronaut, the symbol of them is team outreach. I'm going as far as I can to find as much as I can just to come back and tell you all that I know. I feel like that's who I've been and that's who I embody. And that's the position that embodies me, is when I come back and do that, I want to show and tell people something that allows them to say, hey, you know, if Stephon did that, from everything that he said from day one up to the end result and he did all of that, then maybe I can move out of my hometown. Maybe I can go to college. Maybe I can, you know, go be a lawyer. Who knows? Maybe I can go be a musician. Just knowing that you don't have to accept like the status quo. Yes, it's hard and it's going to work. And there's nothing out here that doesn't require the hard work and the risk of hearing no, and you might not get it. But everything is worth trying because, you know, we only get this opportunity once to drive this avatar called the human body. So
you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, right?
Right. Right. It's facts. And so to me, I want to do that. So not only I can, you know, help advance our scientific and technological feats for the world, but I also want to help each member of our world who makes up the world. You know, who is it that we're trying to help? If the people that we're trying to help can't even feel confident in themselves to try to do more and do better because they can't even apply what we're going out there to find for them.
So much gold. So much gold in that whole idea of venturing out, like you said, and looking out and really studying outward to then turn around and use that to affect what's within, which is what I'm really getting from what you just said, which is really a powerful message. Asma, tell us about asthma and opportunities for people coming up and tell us what it's done for you.
Yes. Just so you know, I'm the co-chair of the mentorship committee for AMSRO. This is the Aerospace Medicine Student and Resident Organization. And we are our own organization apart from asthma, but we are within asthma as well. And so This is an organization that is dedicated for students, medical students, undergrad students, residents. And if you're not in it, please join. I believe it's asthma.org. And
all the details are going to be in the show notes. So please check out the link and everything will be there.
Yes. And it's just a small fee. I think it's like, it used to be $6. But we provide so many opportunities for young explorers, you know, for the mentorship side. We do the speed mentoring every year at the asthma conference, which is the Aerospace Medicine Conference. This year will be in Atlanta, Georgia. And we have 2 days set out where you do like speed dating, but it's for mentors. So the mentors will sit at the table and each student or resident and anybody can be a mentee. So you can sign up and you could be a whole doctor and be a mentee and have somebody, because who knows who's going to help you get to where you're trying to get to or have information for you. Never be afraid of getting wisdom from anyone as many times as you need. And so we do 7 minutes. 7 minutes, you get to chat it up and then the bell rings and you got to move to the next table and you meet your next mentor. And you keep going and going until this whole event's over. And hopefully you've collected a lot of names, numbers, cards, and, you know, you can stay acclimated within the field. And on top of that, you know, some of these mentors want to be long-term mentors. So we're setting up a program to where you can have someone that's in a particular area of aerospace you're looking at, and you can stay in contact with them and they can help kind of guide you on your route. And as much as we're doing that for people that are in our position, us in these levels as medical students and young doctors, we also are mentors. So you need to go down to the next tier, and we need to be mentors to young mentees that are in undergrad, high school, junior high. And we talk to them. So that's also a thing that we're doing to make sure that we're passing this knowledge along, because I didn't learn about this field until I was at the age of 26, 27, approaching 28. You know, some people maybe learned about it early as 13, as 10. And the earlier you learn about it, the more that we can help this field advance. And so I'm all about making sure the young get exposed to flight, diving, astronauts as early as possible. And so with asthma, we have the diversity committee, we have mentorship committees, we have all kinds of leadership positions. And within asthma, there's scholarships. So on the asthma.org page, you can click a tab and there are scholarships listed for young students and as high as residents for opportunities to get money to come to the conference and just for your aerospace endeavors if you've done research and all these other things. And so visiting the asthma page and looking at the scholarship opportunities is a must. And also just know that here in the States, we have the Wings Over Houston air show that most of the aerospace community comes to Houston, to Ellington Airfield, and we supply medical aid as a volunteer effort for the whole weekend, 3 days. And so UTMB hosts it. Their residents are the ones that organize it. And so you just...
Can you just expand on who UTMB are? Sorry, Dan, sorry about that, Stevon, if that's okay.
Yeah. UTMB is the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston. They're a medical school in Galveston, but that is also the home of the aerospace medicine residency that's connected with Johnson Space Center. UTMB Galveston's aerospace residency is in connections with space medicine efforts to help Johnson Space Center. So a lot of flight surgeons for NASA at Johnson Space Center came from the UTMB's aerospace medicine residency. Within that program, there are lots of opportunities to grow. So there's the JSC clerkship, which is during the fourth year of medical school, or any other time after that. You can do this as a resident as well. And basically you spend a month doing research at Johnson Space Center through UTMB. And they also have the flight course. So it's like you learn about aerodynamics and it's like the aerospace medicine flight course. And you can learn about all the aspects of aerospace medicine and space medicine and what its proper position is on intervention for our time now with all right.
And that's not only, you mentioned a few different things there as well. And it can be easy to think that obviously you're in the States and, you know, there's a lot of stuff that you mentioned is related to the States, but actually, especially UTMB, for example, they're not only there for people from the United States. I know that I was actually quite lucky myself to get onto their Principal of Aviation and Space Medicine program, which is going to be done under Zoom rather than being able to actually go out there and join you over in Texas. But you know, that's the way it's living. My point there is just that, you know, I'm from the UK and I just applied for the opportunity and they gave me a place. They had some stuff through the medical school as well, which helped, but it's pretty cool. And yeah, there are those opportunities for the people who go out and perhaps look for them, I guess, which is kind of your message there really, I think, Stevon.
Right, right. Yes. And you're right. Like they are very, very welcoming to anyone from anywhere, international, in states, it doesn't matter. You know, it's just when it comes to looking for these things, aerospace medicine is a very small community in a vast space. I guess you could say.
Pun intended.
But everyone knows everyone. And as you start to learn and grow, you'll start to realize how many people that you know, someone else knows. And, it's a beautiful thing because if you're really interested in it and you're really putting your heart into it, it doesn't have to be about competition because no one can take what you have. You are special in your own right. What you have to offer aerospace medicine will only be what you have to offer. And when you learn what that is and you embrace it, we will too. And I believe, and I think that that's what makes us feel great. You know, we're diverse and we bring so many different perspectives, which is going to make such a great team because that's what our teams are made of, you know, different perspectives, different life experiences, different ways of handling circumstances is what makes the machine work. And so don't be afraid to try and don't be afraid to fall and get back up and do it again, because you'll learn something about that, because not everything worked. I mean, look at our field. We've seen many things that didn't work that people had to recover from. And if they can recover from something such as a, you know, crash or an explosion and devastation that's nationally seen on TV, I think, you know, we as individuals can recover from rejection here or there, or a mistake here or there. So you just got to be authentic about yourself.
So, I mean, Steve-on, like, so much gold, so many golden nuggets in what you're saying there. And I think what's so special about it is that, I mean, all of us are clearly very junior in our careers, and we have so far to go, even though we appreciate, you know, how far we've come. But we're trying to be as intentional as possible and understand and overstand as much as possible so we can guide our path as we move forward. But as we draw to a close now, I'm just thinking about, you know, all those excited, budding, you know, young students out there who are just thinking, you know, how can they jump into this? And Steve-on, could you say perhaps five things that you think they should do? Keep it to five things that you think that these people that are so passionate about this area that want to get more and more experience, what should they do? Where should they go? Who should they talk to? Five things.
Okay. First off, Aerospace Medicine Association and AMSRO, Aerospace Medicine Residents and Students Association. Join them now. Secondly, if you can, start learning how to swim. If you don't know how, if you do know how, keep swimming, learn about the dynamics of swimming, and as well as that, aviation. If you can go to an airfield and get someone to describe to you like what's going on in a cockpit, even if you're not flying, just a pilot that's there, that's a instructor, just why does this work? Why does that work? So take an interest in aviation and diving, those two things. Three, if you can, read some books about people that have gone the way that you've gone. There's a book by Leland Melvin called Chasing Space I like. There's another book called Surviving the Extremes, A Doctor's Journey to the Limits of Human Endurance by Kenneth Kamler. And then also one of my personal favorites was Freedom Flyers, The Tuskegee Airmen of World War II by J. Todd Moy. And outside of that, if you could visit Johnson Space Center or any other space center that's in your, you know, your proximity, whether it be Kennedy or if you can go to the ESA.
European Space Agency.
Yeah, just a moat as well. They have a lot of different things. They have like an opportunities page as well that they have on their page. So, if, you know, even if you're not from the States and stuff, there are programs and things and opportunities out there. Just literally Google them and you can come across something, which is, you know, stuff, as you said, like, as you kind of linked to at the start of this as well, Steve-on, like sometimes you don't even realize that's a possibility for you. And then you look and you realize that actually all the stars are aligning and there is actually no obstacles in the way of pursuing that thing that you didn't think that you could do initially.
Exactly, exactly. And the fifth thing that I would say is find yourself. I would say find yourself, because the only way that you're going to be good at this field or any other field is to be sure of who you are and why you want to do something. So how do you want to serve humanity? Find that out. Ask yourself that question and revisit it thousands of times. Why do I want to do what I want to do? And how do I want to serve humanity? And you can answer those things. Then you can apply them to the field that you're trying to go into.
And how would you go about doing that? Is it just asking those questions, or like, because for you, it seems to be like, and obviously, please correct me if I'm wrong, you were almost in a way quite lucky that you had this opportunity by somebody who you're just interning with. They offered you now a paid research assistantship. And then that was a spark that kind of started this cascade, which then led you down this path. And you were in that field, which, you know, you were in that university, which was so associated with aerospace. And that was what triggered you. But, you know, how would you go about actually, you know, what would be your advice to those people who maybe haven't felt like they've had those moments yet, or those spark moments really quite yet?
I think that, in regards to the finding yourself, that this is different. Because with the finding yourself, this is something that when you have this unwavered will of like, I know what I want to do and I just need to figure out how to get it done. That's when the things start falling. Mm. Because when you start having that about you, the thing that's going to make you and I the same in this process is I had to knock on a door. You're going to have to go knock on a door too. Mm-hmm. And as far as finding them, it's called, you know, you're going to have to go and venture into it. I didn't know which door to lock on. I had to find out what door. So I had to look. I had to read. Mm. I went into that book of mine. I went on Google. I searched. I literally walked around until I could, you know, and I asked people questions. You know, it's a lot of small things that happen along the way that make some of these occurrences seem like it's just like, oh, it just happened out of the blue. It's like, no, when I did research with my master's degree, I heard about the lab and some people from my school that was physiologists and even physicians knew about it as well. And I asked them to show it to me. I asked them to take me. They didn't. They told me like, oh, I'm sorry. I can't get you over there. I don't know where it's at. This, that, and the third. And I was like, okay, so nobody's trying to help me get this. And so I was like, okay, well, I'm about to just go knock on this door myself. I'm going to go find it. And, you know, and I was prepared. I was nervous, you know, and I thought somebody might have, you know, been yell at me or something, but that's not the case. What are your intentions? My intentions aren't malicious. So I shouldn't feel guilty about going after what I'm trying to go after. Because I can explain why I'm trying to do this. It's for a good cause, you know, and I think that's what you have to do. You know what you're trying to do is for a good cause. You know what you're trying to do is intentionally beneficial for yourself and others. Then take the risk to call people, email people, look on those websites, ASMA, AMSRO, and you see the names of people and you don't know them from Adam, even me. You can hit me up. I'm somebody that didn't know somebody back when, but now I know.
How did they hit you up? How did they hit you up? How did they contact you?
Well, you can have my email. It's stevonvoice, lowercase, all one word, @gmail.com. I have Instagram @stevonvoice and Facebook @stevonvoice. Easily, you know, I'm always willing to answer questions or direct people to a proper networking platform. And that's what my job is. That's why I took co-mentorship committee chair. That's why I did that.
And I'm such a big fan of that stuff as well. I don't know if you guys ever had this, but I went to this course about medical school. I remember before I started and stuff, and to help with the application. I remember one thing that really stuck for me from this guy's talk, which was, you know, you're going to have a lot of people that are going to help you to climb that mountain. But once you've climbed it, make sure that you're there putting the rope down for the next person to bring them up with you as well. And I'm such a big advocate of that sort of process. So thank you so much, Stevon, for, you know, allowing people to come in contact with you and giving away your email like that. I think that's really
great. Definitely. The way I look at it is this. You know, you can only, you know, you hit people back when you can. I always feel like some people don't want to give out their stuff. And I'm like, you know, you're not obligated to be on call or be on your email 24/7. It's just, you know, it's there, you know, check back in, say hello, say what you need to say and do that. You know, it's people, it's helping people that help advance you. If you don't learn that now, then you're going to have a hard time because nothing that we do is really for ourselves. Nothing. We have everything that we do is going to be for somebody else, and somebody else's deeds are always going to be for us. Somebody else has to cut the check that we get paid with. So it's, if you can learn to be selfless like that, you'll advance further in life than you've ever advanced, than you can never imagine. And it'll go exponentially. It will. You'll be surprised at how fast everything just blows up.
That's it. Wow. A lot of ground covered in this conversation. It's been extremely insightful. Some knowledge bombs dropped. The top five things for people growing in this industry. try and get involved in asthma, AMSRO, learn to swim, read books. All those books are going to be in the show notes. Try and go to a space station, try and visit a museum, try and speak to people and find yourself. Five top tips from Stevon himself. As we draw to a close now, again, I want to say thank you to Stevon. Thank you for everybody who's watching. Please be active and please act on how you're feeling right now after listening to that. And let's keep going. Any last thoughts, Stevon, before we close?
Yes, I just want to circle back to the swimming, because it's not just swimming. You want to, if you can learn to fly too, do that. But the swimming is important because a lot of training for astronauts is done underwater. So if you ever are planning on becoming an astronaut, you're going to have to get used to being underwater. Not saying that you need to know how to hold your breath forever, but you just need to be used to the pressure of water, because the dynamics under there are very analogous to what they go through out in space. So getting yourself comfortable with that early is a very, very good thing to do.
Mate, I've got nothing more to add. I think that was a really, really interesting kaleidoscope of different things that we managed to cover there. And once again, Stevon, thank you very much for your time. I'm pretty sure we're going to be seeing a heck of a lot of you at some point in the future. So we look forward to it, definitely.
Thank you once again for listening. And that was the Aerospace Medicine Podcast.
Hey everyone, thanks for downloading and listening to our podcast. We hope that you gained a lot from it.
And if you'd like to hear some more stuff like this, much more, make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you found this on. And if you like what you heard, drop us a rating too.
You can also give us a follow on our social media accounts. We are at Aeromed Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. And once again, that's at Aeromed Podcast on Instagram and Twitter.
Also, we like to hear your feedback, of course, improve. So let us know your thoughts by emailing us at aerospacemedicinepodcast@gmail.com. That's aerospacemedicinepodcast@gmail.com.
Until next time, though, thanks so much again for listening. Stay safe, keep aiming high, and we will see you very, very soon.